The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, July 1st, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Heather Parton, or Digby, from the blog Hullabaloo and Salon.com to look back on this exhausting week. Meanwhile, conservatives and corporate polluters celebrate the Supreme Court's crushing the EPA's ability to protect our environment and slow climate change. That same court also allows the Biden administration to end the so-called Remain in Mexico policy. The court announces it will decide whether states can ignore the results of elections and send alternate electors to Washington, among other things. Speaking of alternate electors, January 6th Commission has evidence of attempted witness tampering. And Joe Biden, while he says he supports a filibuster to carve out abortion rights, is also nominating an anti-abortion judge to the federal bench in a supposed deal with Mitch McConnell. Florida judge temporarily blocks a 15-week abortion ban as women across the country are denied healthcare because of other bans. New York State rushes to patch the concealed carry laws in the wake of a Supreme Court decision. Mitch McConnell threatens Democrats he'll hold the semiconductor manufacturing bill hostage if Democrats attempt to do anything along the lines of a completely anemic and shrunken down Build Back Better bill. Lastly, recession fears mount as a result of the Fed's desperate attempt to quash wages. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is the end of the week. I am joined, of course, by Emma Vigeland. What a week, Emma.
What a week. What a week. It feels like I was here for all 5 days, and I just was not. I was not. And yet, like, the emotional toll of this week is multiple weeks combined.
We're going to talk to Heather Parton about this, but in many respects, this is, God, I use this metaphor too often, but this is the famous Bruce Lee. I don't even know if Bruce Lee actually did this. I can't even remember anymore. But the supposed kidney punch, where 3 weeks later, the person drops dead. This week was essentially foretold 6 years ago. And we've had a long time to sort of absorb it and prepare for it. And so, and because of the nature of this sort of like this being rolled out, it doesn't have the same impact as the night when Donald Trump won, but this is what it is. And we'll talk more about this with Heather. And we'll talk about it, I imagine, in the next 2.5 years, this will come up a lot.
And frankly, I think maybe the bleeding would have been slowed a little, or at least the pain associated with it, if the President of the United States' response hasn't been so incredibly dispiriting. I mean, we can't do anything is basically all we've gotten from leadership.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was certainly ways that they could mitigate the situation, but the bottom line is, you know,
they're not
going to be able to do anything. They're not going to be able to do anything about the EPA, for instance. I mean, the totally dismantling of the the administrative state is. I'm not sure what the answer is to that. Frankly,
I mean, Biden doesn't. They don't have a plan for Roe, so they definitely don't have a plan for the dismantling of the administrative state.
But as a political matter, it would have been nice for them to speak up. But the bottom line is that. We're going to get, and certainly we will, and we have, criticized the nature and the lack of the Democratic response. But let's be clear here. This is being done by the conservative movement, and it is being done by the Republican Party. And there was an experiment waged, both in 2000, for that matter, and in 2016. Do Democrats learn some type of magic? Is there a Democratic brain that exists that controls all Democrats? And does that brain learn a lesson when the candidate who should win didn't win? And we can either say it was because people stayed at home and they were trying to send a message or not or whatever. But if you want an experiment as to what happens when you empower Republicans, We have the results of the experiment. And part of the inputs into that experiment is an anemic Democratic Party. This was all knowable in 2016. It was. And, you know, people keep asking me to reissue the debate with Jimmy Dore because it was the one place where it's sort of like we had that argument. Although we were saying
all
throughout. Well, yeah. We will. But
why
but
not?
We will. But we were saying this throughout the whole summer. And it wasn't just Republicans bad. It is Republicans bad and Democrats not good at stopping them.
Yeah, if you agree they're a bad opposition, then you don't want them in opposition.
Exactly. And I mean, we have the results of that experiment. It's right in front of you. You don't have to think about the hypothetical. I mean, I've seen tweets, people saying like, I've never been more proud to have not voted for Joe Biden. If you vote for a sense of pride, then you don't understand what voting is supposed to be about. Voting is not an art project. Voting is not a way to give yourself a medal. Voting is not an expression of who you are inside. It sounds laughable, but
no, it's the narcissism of it. I mean, we were having to relitigate this from 2016, but that is that this is the exact debate that we were having, the exact impulses that we were combating.
Exactly. And it is a tool. And if you have a plan that involves voting for one choice that will lead to the best outcomes. And I mean, like, I kept begging people for that is called a theory of change in the context of electoralism. There's other theories of change you can apply. But like, if you can come up with that and sell it, I'm all ears. But like, you know, it's just sort of just bizarre to watch people go like, I'm proud of the fact that I didn't vote for either one of the candidates. You know what? You're an idiot.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that voters en masse should move away from a lesser of two evils approach for nothing, like there's no alternative. It's just out of your theory of how it's not going to solve the problems, which it might not, but it's like the best vehicle on offer right now.
It's crazy. Here is Scott Pruitt. He was the Oklahoma, I think, head of the state EPA in Oklahoma, if I remember correctly, when Donald Trump appointed him to the federal EPA. His claim to fame when he was put into office, I should say on the federal level, was suing continuously the EPA so that he didn't have to follow environmental laws. That was what his job was. And so he was put there to deconstruct the administrative state, at least on the EPA level. here he is with Newsmax's Rob Schmidt celebrating EPA versus West Virginia.
Rob, think about it. I mean, from a legislative perspective, if Congress doesn't deal with these big issues, they can continue to blame what? They can continue to blame the departments and agencies and administrative agencies that make these decisions and never do the hard work of legislating.
Right.
And the court is really saying to Congress, you must do the job. You must pass the legislation, give the framework to the EPA, give the framework to all these administrative agencies. And you're right. This is much bigger than the EPA. This is across the bureaucracy, the deep state, the fourth branch of government, as we know, the career bureaucrats that exist in all these various agencies now have been sent a very clear message. You can't make it up. You know, the Clean Power Plan that the Obama administration passed, I led that effort along with other states to sue on that as I was attorney general in the state of Oklahoma. Then when I went to the EPA, I repealed it. And then this particular matter is exactly what the court, you know, is
right.
You know, should have done. They sent the message to the administrative agencies. Look, you've got to only do that which you're empowered to do.
I like the fact that he's bragging about repealing a regulation because he had the power to do that. The point is, the Clean Air Act was exactly what he said that they weren't legislating. It is a framework, and it's not just bureaucrats. It is scientists who are assessing what it is we need to achieve the goals set out by Congress. And I agree in many respects that Congress needs to own these things if they pass them, so that the population, citizens can say, oh, we like that or we don't like that. I mean, that's one of the good reasons. I think one of the best reasons to get rid of the filibuster, make the parties own their positions. The idea that these bureaucrats who are scientists and experts in the field don't have the right to take aren't empowered by Congress when Congress says we're passing the Clean Air Act, figure out a way to fight climate change, figure out a way to make our air breathable or safe for people. And they come up with a formula in which to do it, and they're not empowered to do so. I mean, Pruitt laid it all out there. They're going to do this with every agency. So it's not going to be, I want my candy safe for my kids. That's not going to be enough to charge the FDA with, let's say. It's going to have to be, Congress is going to have to come up with a formula. There can't be this much lead in it. There can't be this much. Maybe there's a new method of production of candy that Congress is not aware of, so they can't legislate as to what chemical can't be in candy. I mean, we're going to see this across the board.
And the information that's going to influence Congress to that degree is going to be heavily tilted towards the industries that might want to put lead in the candy, that might want to pollute, because these members of Congress are not experts. They are not scientists. That's why delegating to these agencies is so beneficial, because it's a little bit more insulated from lobbying power and corruption. Now that's the precedent that they want to set, that they have a much more direct line to influencing these kinds of regulations in their favor to help corporate profits than they would if the EPA was able to make its own determinations on this.
They won't even need to lobby, because the EPA is not going to be able to do anything in Congress. There's no way that Congress is going to get is even capable of getting that micro on these things.
Well, and also because the Republican Party has been historically obstructionist, to use a Washington term, for decades at this point. They have hung their hat on it, Mitch McConnell in particular. So the idea that now Republicans are turning around and saying that the only way to get Congress has just got to legislate. Well, they've made it impossible for Congress to legislate for decades at this point, and that's obviously the purpose of this.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, word from our sponsors, and then we'll bring Digby on to talk about this. Heather and I have seen this building for almost two decades now, and it's a little depressing. But that history is important, and as such, We've got a sponsored by a podcast by a guest we've had on this program many times. It's been a while since we've had him on. But Dr. Eddie Glaude. There's always going to be something distinct about our present day, yet history haunts us. American democracy is at a crossroads. We have to decide who we really are as a nation. History is Us, an important six-part documentary podcast series hosted by award-winning Princeton University professor Dr. Eddie Glaude, journeys back to face the truths about race at the heart of the American story. From the aftermath of the Civil War, the mid-20th century struggle for freedom, the election of Barack Obama, and the current day racial reckoning, History is Us asks questions about who we are as a nation, what race might reveal about our current crisis, and where we go from here. Through the voices of distinguished historians and scholars, this limited series gives listeners the background and education to understand how we got here and how we can all use history to clarify the choices before us. Listen to History is Us, a presentation of Shining City Audio, C13 Originals, and John Meacham Studio. Available now wherever you listen to your podcasts. And also, one of our sponsors today, of course, SunsetLakeCBD.com. Left is best. You get 20% off. And I don't know if there's been a week where I've needed it more, ladies and gentlemen. They have CBD sour gummies. They have CBD and melatonin sleep gummies.
Oh, I'm out of those, and it is really screwing me over.
And Emma's fishing for.
I'm out of those. I am out of those.
Elderberry. Those are really great, actually. But yeah. Also, I have really gotten into the flower and the buds and the keef and the pre-rolls. As a relaxant, I use the tincture to go to sleep at night. I give as a gift the fudge, and the coffee is great. It's my weekend brew. All of their products, and this is hugely important about CBD. You don't know where you're getting this a lot of times. They have on their website third-party certification of every analysis of every product they sell, every batch that they harvest. Right now is the big harvest time. I think they're pulling the hemp in or in the process of getting ready to start to harvest a bunch of that hemp. They're also movement partners. We've talked about this in the past. They've given tens of thousands of dollars to places like unions and to union strike funds and to food pantries and to innocence projects and to fight the drug war. Just a great bunch of guys. They use integrated pest management, so there's never any pesticide. They use all natural ingredient, organic fertilizers. I mean, so check it out. You cannot do better. SunsetLakeCBD.com. Left is best for 20% off. Longtime listeners of the show, SunsetLakeCBD.com. Left is best. And don't forget, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can get the free show free of commercials and also get the fun half by becoming a member. Join the MajorityReport.com. All right. I want to bring on Heather
Parton. A quick break, Sam.
Okay. We got to take a quick break and we'll set this up and we'll bring on Digby from the blog Hullabaloo. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Heather Parton, or as you may know her, Digby, from the blog Hullabaloo. Heather, also I should say columnist at Salon.com. How are you?
You ask me that after this week? What do you think?
I was just saying that, you know, this week was really, in many respects, the culmination of, I mean, it's 6 years in the making, right? I mean, this was not completely foretold at this time in 2016, but it was certainly predictable. We certainly had the ability to, you know, that this was a real potential. I mean, in many respects, I would argue it has been this way for, you know, 20 some odd years, maybe even in growing really maybe 50 years, you know, or maybe 45 in terms of like where we led with Roe. But if we had stopped to think about this 20 years ago or 40 years ago, it is not surprising that the Supreme Court that is going to overturn Roe v. Wade is also going to begin to unwind a lot of other things about our, you know, now 21st century, or I should say 22nd century, 21st century way of life, essentially.
Oh, you know, I think, I mean, going back to what you said at first there, it's been 6 years. I mean, I think we all remember the morning after the election of 2016, how we felt, that horrifying, empty feeling of dread and horror at what was awaiting us. And this was a huge part of that. This was, I mean, we all knew that Donald Trump was a clown and a, you know, completely inept and unqualified for the job of president. And we were shocked and stunned that this could happen in our country, that someone like him could become president. But the ramifications of it were always, at least for me, and I think for an awful lot of people, what was going to happen with the court. We'd already seen what Mitch McConnell was capable of before the election. And the only thing that was saving us at that point that was that we would have a Democratic president who would nominate, you know, I mean, we figured Mitch couldn't hold out for 4 years. So he'd have to replace that seat and then hopefully, you know, maybe more with, you know, more liberal justices. And when that didn't happen, I think we all just felt this complete, you know, sense that, as you say, the 45 or 50 years that were leading up to this, that we had finally reached the sort of culmination of the rights battle to dominate the court. But I have to say that even with that, the dread that I felt, the horror that I felt, this week kind of, you know, it was worse than I imagined, to be honest with you. I felt that it was worse than I thought it was going to be. I had assumed that there would be at least still some desire on the part of these people to at least kind of cover their, you know, their goals a little bit, and that they would at least try and maintain some sense that of respectability and legitimacy of the court. And it's clear now that they don't care. They don't care. And it's not just in the results that they've gotten. It's in the opinions themselves. They're basically just telling everybody, hey, whatever, what are you going to do about it? You know, and I'm frankly pretty stunned, even though I was one of those people who took to my bed for a week after 2016, knowing that this was coming and understanding what we were going to probably be dealing with. Even as someone like that, I have been this week, frankly, shocked that everything coming from the guns decision to Roe, of course, which we knew, but even so, it's worse than I thought. And then these last two decisions, and then yesterday's agreement to take up the case, the independent state legislature's case next fall. I'm okay. All bets are off. The gloves are off. They're just going to do it. And they're saying, what are you going to do about it?
I think that's a good point about Roe, because I think that had I, you know, I'm quite convinced that at the very least, you know, prior to the Texas case, I guess, I would have said they're going to chip away at it. They're just going to chip away at it, and it'll be a 2 or 3 year process in which they chip away at Roe v. Wade, and they'll offer. But you're right. This is, I mean, on one level, like, you know, we've said for a while, they are theocrats, and they are. I mean, they are mm-hmm. zealots, and they are theocrats, and I mean this literally. And you don't really get humility that much with theocrats, right? I mean, right. You know, Roberts has always been a little bit cagey in the way that he unwinds these things. And everyone else on that court is to the right of Roberts, at least in not necessarily an agenda, but in that sort of like there is a worldview and a disposition towards other human beings by fundamentalists, the religious fundamentalists, and they're fundamentalists, you know, to the extent that like Brett Kavanaugh is not a fundamentalist. He's just a go along to get along type of guy. They have God on their side, and so they can't go wrong.
Well, that's right. And in fact, one of the best things that I saw on Twitter this week in regards to what you're saying is that, you know, there's all this talk about originalism and how, you know, we have to go back and look at the history and what the founders were thinking as they went to bed at night when they were putting together the Constitution. And one of the some Twitter wags said, yeah, here's what the founders were thinking. Wait, you're telling me that the majority on the court are Catholic? I mean,
right.
It's kind of, you know, I mean, that was not an originalist kind of thought at the time. Not that there's anything wrong with Catholics being on the court. I'm not suggesting that. But this is a very, very conservative Catholic majority, particularly the last justice that we just put on there. I mean, Amy Coney Barrett, I mean, she was literally part of kind of an extremist Catholic cult. For, you know, I mean, and that's not an exaggeration, and I'm not trying to insult her. It's just the truth. I mean, this is where she comes from. So you're right. A lot of this comes from this, you know, this very, very, you know, right-wing fundamentalist theological position. And then you have this hardcore partisanship that's clearly just, I mean, and people like Clarence Thomas, who yesterday they quoted that he believes that the vaccines for COVID vaccines, or derived from, you know, aborted babies. I mean, this is a guy who's like on QAnon or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how far he is. And we know about his wife, of course, who is also part of the right wing, you know, extremist faction. And, you know, this is a really, really very, very difficult and you know, very thorny problem. And I guess, you know, here I am on your show again, you know, talking about what do we do. And again, I'm kind of running up against the sense that nobody's going to do anything. Go ahead.
No, it's okay. I thought you were done there. I didn't mean to cut you off. But the point that you make about Clarence Thomas, him saying this QAnon stuff and these not crazy conspiracy theories about aborted babies being in the vaccines. I mean, one, it's almost clarifying to people, hopefully, that they understand that these right-wing justices and all Republicans are really in the same boat of crazies, and it's not just the MAGA or the whatever Biden's right. trying to call it, ultra-MAGA. But at the same time, the fact that Biden has basically ruled out impeachment for Clarence Thomas as this case is going to be taken up, the one that you mentioned at the start, the North Carolina case about elections for federal office and making a more politicized process and potentially taking the courts out of it, that could be grounds. We should start impeachment proceedings now, given the ties that Ginni Thomas has to these groups, because this could set the groundwork for something incredibly scary in 2024.
This case, and I actually wrote about it for Salon this morning. This case that they said they're going to take up next fall is truly, it is the greatest threat that we have to our democracy, I think, that's out there. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on in the states. There's no doubt about it. They're putting in a bunch of cronies and henchmen into a various election offices around the state. And there's every chance that there's going to be some manipulation and God only knows what with these Trumpist people in these positions. But this case, which is, this is an amazing thing because the story behind it is very interesting. It all goes back to Bush versus Gore. Surprise, surprise. William Rehnquist wrote an opinion in Bush versus Gore that was signed on to by both Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas. What a trio, right? And what he said in that was Rehnquist was trying to find some rationale for the federal government getting involved in what was really a state issue in Bush versus Gore. They were trying to determine the outcome of the election. And they had, the state Supreme Court down there had said, we're going to have a recount. We're going to recount all the votes in these disputed places, and they're going to be recounted by judges. I don't know if you remember that. That the recount that was going on when they stopped the count in Bush versus Gore was a bunch of guys in robes were counting the votes. This wasn't some got people, peering at the chads. These were actual judges that they had called in to do the recount, right? Now, you would assume that any court would say, okay, these guys are legit. They're not going to cheat. We have faith in our judges to do that. Well, Bush versus Gore blew that out of the water. And one of the rationales they used to do that was to say that, well, state legislatures have the final word. That's this independent state legislature doctrine, which isn't a doctrine. It's just something that Rehnquist, pulled out of his back pocket on that day. Well, in any case, nobody took it seriously. That case was that case, right? It is what it is, and we all heard it. John Paul Stevens wrote a dissent and he could specifically address that, said, what you're doing by overturning the state Supreme Court's ruling, and he didn't say it, but I've always assumed that he was also talking about the fact that, judges were doing the counting, so you should have some faith that they're going to do it right. That basically the court was saying that, you're destroying all trust people have in the judiciary by doing this, by taking this. And you're saying that state courts can't be trusted. Well, that I had never thought about it again, to be honest with you. I mean, I'm no lawyer, certainly no constitutional scholar, but I've studied a lot about Bush versus Gore. It's a very, important case. And I never thought about that part of it again until just before the 2020 election. Suddenly, this thing is rearing its ugly head again. And Brett Kavanaugh refers to it in a case up in Wisconsin where it was one of those shadow docket cases. And it was about, it's a late counting of ballots. The court rejected it, said it was too late and whatever. The full court did. But Kavanaugh wrote a weird footnote in that case saying, well, state legislatures really do have the final word. And a lot of people's ears perked up and went, whoa, what's going on here? Subsequent to that, a week later, Gorsuch, Thomas, and Alito signed on to another one in a Pennsylvania case, basically saying the same thing. So we all knew there were four justices suddenly who had revived this very obscure sort of concept of the independent state legislature doctrine, whatever that was. So that's been hovering out there through this whole time. Now, of course, we know after the election and when they went and did all these challenges all over the country, John Eastman, Giuliani, the rest of these guys, they were citing this. And that's what they were trying to do when they're calling up Georgia and saying, hey, can you find me the votes, right? This was in service of this idea that the state legislatures could call special sessions. And they had, plenary power to do whatever they want with elections. No other actor in state in state government has the power, not a state Supreme Court, not the governor. For instance, if the state legislature were to say, we're going to overturn the election and here's a law we're writing to make that happen, the governor would have no veto power under this, under their normal constitution. The state constitutions would have no power. In other words, if a state has said the electoral count must reflect the majority will of the voter, that's in the state constitution, out the window. Federal law would supersede that. And the federal law, as these people see it, is that state legislatures are supreme, with only the Supreme Court of the United States having the final say if should they want to do it. This is the craziest thing. It is an absolutely wild concept that now the Supreme Court has taken up. And there are people who say, well, they should take it up since it's flying around out there and people are using it. Maybe they need to decide.
Huh.
I differ a little, especially after this week, because we know what they're going to do.
Yes, they're going to say that state legislatures have supremacy, that they cannot be constrained by state courts, that to the extent that they can be constrained by federal courts, it will end with the Supreme Court, which right. we know if they decide this, they're going to rule in their favor. And the other important thing to understand, too, is Republicans control like what, 30 of these, maybe more, 30, yeah. 30 sub odd of these state houses. And there it is. There's your minoritarian rule and done. We're done. Because not only can they say, okay, we're not going to have, I mean, it's going to completely invalidate, right, the Voting Rights Act. It seems to me, I mean, if the state legislature has the ultimate authority, I don't understand how federal law could supersede it in any way. And but on top of that, they have the ability to say like, oh, this year we're, you know, on November 10th, we didn't like the outcome of the way that the voters voted for the electors. We're going to pass a law that says in, you know, 2024. The state house will choose the electors, end of story.
Absolutely.
And then we don't have to send fake ones to DC. I should also just say this thing about Thomas, and I don't know how exactly he you know, what exactly his belief is, but I think there are some COVID vaccines that do have some stem cell, fetal cell, in them, in terms of the development, at least, of these, just like vaccines for chickenpox and hepatitis and shingles and rubella, and I don't know how many other vaccines have this. This is technology that's been around for 60 years. So it's interesting that Thomas is just finding out about the COVID vaccine. That, I think, is more telling than the fact that I imagine when he got a Shingrix vaccine, he wasn't too worried about that. But yeah, this is lunacy. And the fervor in which, like, the train, once we hit six, right, it was like all bets are off. It was just right. like it is a runaway train. And that's what we're looking at. The only thing they're constrained by, it seems, is just, I don't know, how much work they're willing to do. And the bottom line is they're going to have decades in which to do this work. They're going to have decades. Just this year, when you think about all the things like the Sixth Amendment, where you have a right to effective counsel, it has been severely undercut. The individual right for a person to get an abortion, gone. The ability of Congress to broadly give an objective to executive agencies to achieve in society, gone. The tribal sovereignty chipped away at it, the very least. I mean, this is just like in the past, like 2 weeks. And it's fascinating. And the only, well, on some level, it's mitigated by the case that they're taking up. But you wrote a piece this week about how Republicans are backing off. And we've been talking for the past couple of days about how the right is working overtime to pretend that the Roe v. Wade decision was meaningless. Mm-hmm. It is fascinating how they know how unpopular their agenda is relative to the American public. And that's why they are smart enough to, here's the steak we're delivering, but we're also working on the plates, essentially,
right?
Like, we're also making sure that we're able to plate this meal for you. And that's what the case that they're picking up now, where they're basically just working on this minoritarian rule, and they're going to need it because, and we'll talk about the sort of the Democratic response in a moment, but this is an interesting it's fascinating to see them run away from their long held desire.
Absolutely. I mean, I was really stunned by that. And I did write a piece about it because I couldn't believe I went to and watched Fox News that, you know, I do this for you people, you know, just so that you, just to let you know what's going on over there. And it's not easy. Let me tell you, I have to drink heavily after I do this. It was astonishing to me because I would have expected they would do backflips, that this is their greatest achievement. This was their holy grail. And they were not doing backflips. They were saying, "It's relax, ladies. It's okay. You're going to be able to get your abortions. You'll be able to get them. Don't worry. You just, you know, if this is a state thing and nothing terrible is going to happen to you, everything's going to be fine." And I was really surprised that they took that tack. But the thing that really did it for me was when I read about Donald Trump being extremely upset about, I shouldn't say extremely upset, worried about it, because he thinks that, you know, he knows he's got a problem with women and he's looking at 2024 and saying, you know, wow, this is really going to hurt me. It took them 2 days to persuade him to go out and take a victory lap. Now, which he did. He came out, look, it's the greatest decision in the history of mankind. But it took him a couple of days to do that, which with Donald Trump, right? I mean, he takes victory laps over the sun coming up in the morning. The fact that it took him any time at all to go do that was very telling. And it ended up, and I think he's right. I mean, to the extent he has political instincts, his political instincts are toward his own self-preservation. And I think that he understood very clearly that this is the kind of thing that could shift the dynamic that everybody thought was there. And I actually think it has. In fact, there's a poll that came out this morning. I think it's the AP poll that shows not just abortion, not just Roe and the reversal of Roe, but women's rights in general, suddenly taking on huge new salience, particularly among women, but also among men. That suddenly people are waking up and going, wow, this stuff is really in the crosshairs now. And I think there's absolutely no doubt that gay rights, LGBT rights are also on the agenda. This is definitely happening. There was a debate, I think it was last night in Michigan, one of the governor's races, where they asked people, should they reverse, you know, Obergefell and, you know, and Lawrence. And they're all going, yeah, we need to revisit those. I mean, those governor candidates, Republican governor candidates, are all saying, yeah, we need to do it. So this is definitely on the menu. And, you know, again, it will be another thing that they'll do exactly like we just discussed with Roe. The court will take it up. They'll do whatever. These are going to work their way through the courts over the next couple of years. And then the rest of them will go, oh, don't worry, gay people. Don't worry, you know, don't worry, LGBT kids. It'll be fine because they're going to try and paper it over around elections. But make no mistake, anybody, that this is not real and that they're not actually doing this. And I wouldn't have bet on it, to be honest with you. I was afraid of it. I knew that it was a possibility, but I wouldn't have bet that they would go here. But now I'm totally convinced that they will. After watching what they did this term, these decisions that came down in the last couple of weeks, absolutely convince me that they're going to go for it. They're going to do whatever it takes, and there's no stopping them.
There is no, to use the court's term, limiting principle on what they're going to do. I mean, the one limiting principle was that there have been jurists in the past, and I think Roberts is like this, where they're acutely aware of the role they play in society, and they want to basically, you know, slowly boil the frog. The five that are controlling the court now, this is microwave type of stuff that they're working on. And we should say here is, and what's also, but just get to, back to the point of, and you cited that poll where there has been a real increase in the importance of abortion rights and women's rights in the minds of voters in terms of the polling that's just come out in the wake of the Roe reversal. I want to put up this tweet. It is from I believe they're a New York State OBGYN retweeting a colleague in Missouri who I believe is a lawyer for a hospital. Put this tweet up. This is number 6, and I don't know if you'll be able to see this, Heather, but it says, that essentially, I don't have it, put it up here. It is OBGYN colleague in Missouri, quote, "We are now observing patients with ectopic pregnancy and hemopentatorium until they have a documented failing hemoglobin or unstable vital signs." In other words, and there are 43,000 ectopic pregnancies, more or less, a year. And this is where, you know, one of those things that puts a woman's, or I should say a person who's pregnant, life in danger. And instead of performing an abortion on these people in that moment, they are waiting until they are well on to dying before they intervene, which is going to mean, and this is something we've been talking about the past week, because, you know, this is the lawyer of the hospital now, because they're advising their doctors, we need to go in. It needs to be a slam dunk that a person is dying, that their life is in danger. And how do you get there? Right? Like, this is the way you think about it. It's like, is a kid, a five-year-old's life in danger when they're 20 feet from a cliff that has no fence? Are they in danger and there's nobody within 20 feet of them? Is their life in danger? Is their life in danger when they're 10 feet from that cliff? Is their life in danger when they're 2 feet from that cliff? Is their life in danger only when they're falling off that cliff? And the person who we're relying on to save that in this scenario could be facing 10 years in jail, could be facing loss of license. So if that kid's 20 feet from the cliff, well, I don't know. If they're 10 feet, I'm not sure which way are they facing. If they're 5 feet, I don't know how a court is going to decide that person's life is in danger. And we now are starting to see evidence of it. And what we're going to see over the next probably 3 or 4 weeks, if we haven't already, is women dying, as people who are pregnant dying because of these bans that are, you know, I don't think all 13 are in place from the trigger. I think a couple got held up, but we're going to start seeing this. And we're going to see people I don't know if it's, I'm not going to report anything that's like, you know, maybe apocryphal on Facebook, but you can start to see indications of scenarios like this. It seems to me that reporting is going to do part of the work to make people understand just exactly what's going on here, because it's still, you know, I think people don't really know. But the other thing that is key is that Democratic leadership has to be out there and acting as if, and we have talked about this so many times, Heather, where it's like, you know, we talked, both of us were in the film business. It's the reaction shot. You need to show, we were talking about this in the context of impeachment. You need to show, if something is horrible, we need to see it on your face. We need to see it on the faces of everybody around it. And when the Democratic leadership supports somebody who is anti-abortion in Texas, or when Joe Biden makes a deal with Mitch McConnell, and the deal may in and of itself be a good deal, I don't know, makes a deal to put an anti-abortion judge on the federal bench, we're not seeing it on their faces. When you know, Clyburn comes out and says, well, you know, we've been expecting this, we're not seeing it on their faces. And
I'll add, while Sam's frozen, I will add Clyburn and the rest of Democratic leadership undercut themselves by campaigning for a anti-abortion Democrat. Yep. In Texas, in Henry Cuellar versus Jessica Cisneros. I mean, I am... we played yesterday on the program when Sam was off the clip of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez basically explaining how the Supreme Court needs to be kept in check by the other two branches, which is using institutionalism to your benefit, right? And it's true, right? Everything she's saying. But everything that she's communicated has been, so many steps above what the Biden administration has communicated in terms of action plans. And I don't understand how you can say mobilize and go to the polls to fight Republicans when you're not willing to fight Republicans yourself.
Well, it's absolutely true. And I agree with you about AOC. I think her responses have been really quite brilliant. She was on Stephen Colbert this week, which I wish she'd do more of that kind of popular, you know, non-political stuff, because she's really, really good at sort of explaining things like this, political issues like this, in ways that I think people who don't follow politics can understand. She was great on there, and she has a lot of clarity. And also, it's, you know, I mean, sure, she's throwing out a lot of things, but she's saying, you know, look, there are steps we could take. Maybe some are too extreme or impossible for some reason, you know, due to whatever, but, you know, you have to at least be thinking along these terms. She's conveying the urgency of the moment. And I just want to say one thing. Part of the urgency of this is what Sam, you were saying earlier, which was about doctors being afraid now and being, you know, really concerned that they're going to be. It's not just that the law is going to come after them. We have a vigilante culture that's growing up in this country, and it's always been there with abortion. They've been, you know, there's been a terrorist movement for the last 50 years that has, you know, particularly the last 40 years, that has gone after doctors who perform abortions. And they've basically scared most doctors out of the field of even, you know, performing abortions. But now, because it's become so acute, this idea that they've gone so extreme on abortion to the point where, you know, no exceptions. In case of rape or incest, or no except, you know, having these draconian kind of approaches to it, where doctors are afraid that if they don't wait until a woman's vital signs are failing, that they can't save her, that they are now afraid of this vigilante culture. In Texas, they actually institutionalized it. So that's also a specter that's hanging over all this. And it's one of the things that I think ties in, you know, this issue with everything else that's going on. And if the Democrats they do what they want. But, you know, my feeling is that it's necessary for them to do exactly what you just said, Emma, is to be out there and to be conveying the urgency of what's going on, and not just, you know, kind of going, well, you know, we got to be practical here. And, you know, so we need this seat down in Texas. I mean, you know, the idea that or this judge in Kentucky, which I do not understand this at all. And I don't, anybody who would trust Mitch McConnell when it comes to the courts, I don't know how that can possibly be, that Biden extracted anything from him for doing that. And in fact, the governor of Kentucky says this is, you know, an absolutely horrifying choice, that McConnell couldn't get that judge appointed during Trump. So what in the hell is happening now that he can get him under Biden? So that, you know, that's something to keep your eye on. But, you know, across the board, what we're dealing with here is this what it appears to be from the Democratic Institutional Party is paralysis. That's what it looks like to me. As I'm watching it, I just don't see a sense. I mean, they come out and go, well, you got to vote in November. They're not saying why. They're not saying what that means. How does that translate into change? And in that AP poll I quoted earlier, there were a lot of people that were quoted in there kind of going, gee, I just feel so helpless. I don't know what to do. They have to give people a sense that there is something to be done here. And yes, it is extreme. It has to be. We're dealing with an extreme, you know, party, an extreme Supreme Court. If the Democrats don't meet that moment, then they will prevail. There is nothing to be done. So they need to say things. Now, I mean, we talked about this, I think, maybe a couple months ago, that it's not enough to just throw out, you know, codify Roe and put it on the floor and have all the Republicans vote against it and have all the Democrats vote for it. And gee, too bad, we need two more senators. That does not convey the urgency of what is happening. What would convey the urgency? If you want to put, you know, votes on the floor, put up individual issues involved with that. Are you going to vote for an exception for rape and incest? Are you going to vote for, you know, I mean, for allowing women to cross state lines? What that does is put Republicans on the spot in their home, you know, in their home districts and in their states, with all these crazy people, with the Trump base who is demanding all these extreme policies, they will have to defend whether or not they, if they say, no, we, you know, rape or incest, we do believe in an exception. They have to defend that to their base. If they say they don't believe in an exception, then they're going to have to defend that to the broader public wherever they're running. You have to, it's no longer useful to just say, I'm pro-life. Oh, well, I'm pro-choice. Those are not useful things. Roe is gone. We can't, that's not there for us to say, gee, if we, you know, we believe in a constitutional right to choose, because we don't have it anymore. So now you've got to go in and you've got to get to the heart of this issue and explain how extreme these people are and how ridiculous it is for people in state houses or, you know, a bunch of men in black robes to be making these kinds of very, very difficult and intimate decisions. They got to get back to square one and start doing that sort of thing. I see very little appetite for that. And in fact, they are champing at the bit. I can feel it, to get back to those kitchen table issues because they don't want to talk about this stuff. They don't want to talk about Roe. They don't want to talk. I mean, we haven't talked about guns, what they just did in the wake of one of the worst mass shootings in American history. What did they, you know, what the court just, you know, released, let's unleash guns on more guns on the streets of America. They just did, in that latest ruling with the concealed carry from New York. That, you know, these are issues and, you know, like Josh Hawley was on Fox News this week and he said, or I guess it was just last night, and he said, people don't care about these things. People don't care about abortion. They don't care about guns. They don't care about January 6th. Really? Okay. Well, let's test that.
Clip. We have that clip actually. This is, Josh Hawley on with Sean Hannity. And, you know, again, this is consistent with, the right, I think, sort of feeling concerned that there's an opportunity here for Democrats, because none of the things that have happened with the Supreme Court are even remotely popular, and they're going to get worse. I mean, because people are going to die. Here's Josh Hawley on Sean Hannity.
Reince's question. Will their strategy of running on January 6th, Roe v. Wade being overturned, the Second Amendment, is that going to be successful in any way to gin up their base, motivate their base?
No, because they're talking about issues that only they care about, that nobody else cares about, that doesn't affect the lives of real people, or that they're wrong on. I mean, take abortion again. What are you going to say to people? No, you shouldn't have a choice in what your laws are in your own state. That's what they're telling people. January 6th. The only people who care about January 6th are the Democrats in Washington, D.C.
Objectively, we can look at the polls and we see that's not the case, right? I mean, right. Objectively, we can look at that. Democrats, I mean, they are clearly afraid of these issues moving to the fore. And so it would be, you know, and with good reason. And so you'd think it would be obvious for Democrats to be pushing this stuff. Like Joe Biden, I don't know if he is authorized to have to provide abortions or to provide space in federal buildings in specific states as an abortion provider. But As soon as this story about Missouri comes out of Missouri Hospital, I would go on television and say, we have seen these stories. We are setting up clinics for mm-hmm. doctors who fear that the lives of women are in danger, but are afraid to perform a necessary abortion, not an elective abortion. We're giving them a space to do that so that they can do this without being afraid of being, convicted under the Mississippi mm-hmm. abortion ban. Why would you not do that? You know, why wouldn't you force that conversation to be a national conversation at that point? Because 60-70% of the country is going to be like, well, of course they should be allowed to do this. Well, I get bad news for you. They're not. This is a conversation that needs to happen. While we're here, because we were also, you know, talking the Supreme Court, the decision to pick up this case about the electors coming out of the state. We haven't touched on January 6th. And this week, the hearing with Mark Meadows' lieutenant, essentially, was, I think we need to see the sort of the other side of this, but it was connective tissue between two, you know, real sort of strands of this, which is what they were doing in the White House and what was happening outside the White House with the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. And in this week, that connective tissue was basically, at least we saw like sort of almost like the MRI of it. We haven't seen it in person, but we've seen the MRI of it, and largely in part because this Hutchinson, she changed lawyers and was no longer with a lawyer being paid by Donald Trump. And so she decided to testify publicly. You wrote about this. It's interesting. They're doing the same thing with her testimonies. They're sort of doing with the Roe decision. They're basically saying, mm-hmm. like, nothing to see here. Here's one tiny. Yeah. I mean, talk about that a little.
Right. She's just a little coffee girl. You know, it was no biggie. And basically, you know, she couldn't have possibly seen what she said she saw, et cetera, et cetera. Right. Well, yeah, I think what you just mentioned, this connective tissue, I think that this was the first glimpse that we've had of how they're bringing this entire coup plot and the various strands of it, which Liz Cheney, in her opening statement in the original primetime hearing, indicated, you know, that the plot was, you know, there were several different strands of it, and that they were all leading to the same thing. And it was as if they had, you know, they tried this, and then they tried this, and they tried this. And they had all these legal, you know, attempts to, well, quasi-legal attempts to try and deal with this thing through the court. And then finally, the final, you know, the last ditch effort, if you will, of January 6th, we did not know whether or not the White House was directly involved in that. And we still don't know. But what we did find out was that Trump and Meadows, and probably a number of others, were completely unsurprised by the fact that there was violence at the Capitol that day. They didn't. I mean, Mark Meadows kept doom scrolling when he goes, "Yeah, well, thanks for letting me know." When they came in and told him there were armed, you know, rioters in the crowd. Donald Trump said, "You know, bring them in. You know, get rid of the metal detectors. I want all these armed people in my crowd, which I'm now going to send up to the Capitol." You know, we found that neither of them were surprised by events that were happening that day. Now, maybe they just were tired. Perhaps they just didn't have a reaction for other reasons. But it stands to reason that they did know. And I've mentioned this on here before. One of the comments that has really struck me from the moment I read it was in the Woodward and Costa book on the night of January 5th, that Trump was once more trying to pressure Mike Pence to do what he did. And Pence said, "I don't have the authority to do it." And Trump was standing at the window, opened the door, and it was cold air coming in. This was very, you know, very vibrant, detailed description of the room in the Oval Office. And there was a crowd outside because they were having rallies the night before, including the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers. And they were coming in, and they could hear him cheering out there in the street. And Trump turned to Pence when he said, "I don't have the authority." And he said, "What if these people say you do? Wouldn't that be cool?" I mean, I guess you can say he was just talking off the top of his head. But to me, it sounded from the moment I read it that he had at least some knowledge of the fact that these people, that there were plans afoot to pressure, to use the crowd to pressure Pence to do what he wanted him to do. And these meetings that were being held at the Willard Hotel, you know, the war room with Steve Bannon. I mean, you know, it's hard to believe that this group of misfits could have been, you know, heading up this coup plot. But when you look at what happened, you can sort of see it that, you know, maybe that's all it takes is a crew of misfits to pull something like that off. And they, you know, Meadows was going to go over there. According to Cassidy Hutchison, he said, "I got to go to a meeting over at the Willard." And she somehow talked him out of doing it and said, "Why don't you just call in," which he did. Why was Mark Meadows calling into the Willard Hotel? Why Donald Trump told him to call Roger Stone and Mike Flynn? both of whom were heavily involved with, one with the Proud Boys. Mike Flynn was very involved with the, you know, with the coup plotters at the Willard. All of that is starting to lead to this idea that, you know, the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys are the only people in this whole thing who've been charged with seditious conspiracy. You don't have to be present at the riot to be charged. In fact, one of the leaders of the Proud Boys, Enrique Terrio, has been charged with seditious conspiracy. He wasn't there. So, you know, this is, I think, where we're leading, and there are going to be new hearings coming up after the fourth, you know, after the break here. And those are going to be led, I think, by Jamie Raskin, who is doing the January 6th, insurrection hearings. And I just have a suspicion that we're going to see more of that connective tissue fleshed out. And we're going, the MRI is looking a little vague right now, right. But I think it's going to become more clear as we look at the new hearings.
Just
the whole thing reeks of Roger Stone in terms of Absolutely. Like the kinds of dirty tricks that he likes to foment, and the fact that Stone was having conversations with people in the White House, it seems abundantly clear that at the very least there was a baseline of understanding, and that the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers were feeling their oats, right? Like, yeah, we're working with the White House here. We're this paramilitary, these two paramilitary groups, which explains their recon efforts in order to map things out. I mean, all of this is they're doing a good job of painting a really good picture of this. And the only thing right-wing media wants to focus on is the ketchup on the walls. And they're pretending right. that none of the other the web that's being spun and being communicated, they're just pretending they don't see it.
Right. And the same too, I would say, with the car story. And I actually right. believe the car story was real. And I think it backfills, you know, what Trump thought he was doing. But that I don't think is the meaningful stuff. Like when Scipione says to Hutchinson 4 or 5 days, you know, like on January 2nd, we got to be careful or we're going to get charged here.
Yeah.
That's why they want him to come and testify, because how does a lawyer 4 days from what is we're led to believe just a rally that we don't know if there's going to be anybody, how are they worried 4 days out about getting prosecuted for, you know, essentially whatever it is, defrauding the country? I mean, they were aware there were certain people in that White House who were aware of the conversations that were happening, because they could almost like overhear it. You know, the Giuliani bringing up the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys in that hallway or down the, like, why is that name? Why are those, what is the explanation that those words are being uttered in the White House, except for I'm working with, or we need more security because we're aware of, but they didn't have more security. I mean, there's a reason why those names are being thrown around in there. And so let me ask you this, like where does this lead? Because at the same time, we also have Joe Biden out there, and they did a focus test, you know, 6 months of like consultant class, just BS. And they've come up with, what is it? Uber MAGA, Ultra MAGA.
Ultra MAGA.
I mean, this is insanity. Like, first off, how do people vote against ultra MAGA? Like, who's right. got UM behind their, in parens behind their name? Like, who? This is his. Here it is. Folks, let's get this one thing straight. The ultra MAGA agenda has always been taking away women's rights in every single state. I don't know who ultra MAGA is, but it also happens to have been the Republicans' agenda.
And
like,
also,
even
right,
Liz Cheney, even the blessed Liz Cheney, who,
Yep.
willing to, throw her sister under the bus when it comes to gay marriage, and willing to, chastise people when it comes to torture. And I mean, on and on, even the blessed one, she also has been promoting, take away a woman's right to choose. And so
absolutely,
this is just insanity. It really is. I mean, you know, you could, I think there's an argument that there are certain Democrats who are there to protect corporate rights from the Democratic Party, but they're like, what could possibly explain ultra MAGA other than sheer incompetence?
Well, I think that's what it is. And I, you know, this obviously they had done, they'd done these focus groups where they found that, you know, people really, the idea that there's somehow there's Republicans and then there's MAGA and then there's ultra MAGA. And you want to make somebody be afraid to be ultra MAGA or afraid to vote for ultra MAGA.
It's because, like, different Pokemon, you know, there's the Pokemon levels.
Exactly.
Like, right?
Like,
the evolutionary, like, processes.
Well, I mean, is there a good MAGA? Is that like the ultra MAGA is the bad one and the regular MAGA is the good MAGA and the Republicans, they're just great? I mean, I don't know, but, you know, we do hear a lot about this thing. You know, we want a strong Republican Party. We need to have a strong Republican Party like we used to have. I'm going, no, not really, because that's what got us here in the first place. Besides which, you know, telling Democrats they need to work for Republicans just seems to me to be the stupidest thing I've ever heard, just generally speaking, much less right now. But you're right. Look, it's Republicans. And if what you're trying to do is tell people, trying to make them, you know, make people vote against these extreme views that are coming out of the right now, that are coming out, you make them vote against Republicans. Make being a Republican a shameful thing.
Absolutely.
Tell people, look, this is what your part, you know, and I mean, obviously what they're trying to do, they're trying to coax over a few, you know, swing suburban moms or whatever that vote Republican. And they think, you know, we don't want to insult them by saying the Republicans are bad. So we'll just say it's these other people, the ultra MAGAs. But the truth is they should be told that being a Republican is bad. There should be. I mean, if you're a person who has a conscience, you're pro-choice, you know, care about little kids being gunned down in schools, you care about the democracy being, you know, attempted coups and the democracy being overthrown, you should not be a Republican, because that is what these people are. That is who they are. That's what they're doing. And the Democrats should, what is so hard about that? I honestly don't understand it. I don't get it.
Even if they think that they're going to offend the sensibilities, then what you do is you say ultra MAGA Republicans. Like, you
at least put that in there. You're right. At least put Republican in there.
They're not some, like, weird third party from, like, alien, like an alien country that is invaded. It's, no, they have grown out of the Republican Party. Even if I accept that premise, you know, I'll tell you something that I've said this in the past many times too. My experience at Air America was seeing the consultant class come in. And it is done because people think that they just don't have, they have no answers. And the person with the shiniest watch comes in. And the assumption is they have that shiny watch because they know what they're talking about, as opposed to they have the best presentation and can really snow people who don't have a clue as to what they're doing. And right. That's what, I mean, this ultra MAGA thing, it is honestly, it's as if, like, you know, some of the people in this leadership haven't been outside, you know, and if there's a deal with Mitch McConnell and Joe Biden, and Joe Biden somehow is going to get accelerated judges because of putting this abortion, anti-abortion judge, who's a lunatic, incidentally. I mean, he's not just, you know, run-of-the-mill anti-abortion. I mean, he is a lunatic. Some of the stuff that he has ruled on in the past. Where was Chuck Schumer? When Chuck Schumer was in the minority, like, where was the deal that he could strike with Donald Trump to get, you know, a socialist on the bench, on the federal bench? Like, I don't know why it is that the Republicans seem to have these special powers, but it's fascinating and incredibly depressing. And one hopes that maybe the some of the Democrats will get the message. I mean, AOC has been the only one, like you said earlier, who has been, you know, who has, like, a platform and has been articulating the urgency of the moment.
Right. And she says something that to me is just really explained. She says we have a crisis of legitimacy. I mean, to me, that is, you know, and then she goes on to explain what that means. We have a crisis of legitimacy. Our institutions are failing. You've got, you know, they've been taken over by extremists. And across the board, they are, you know, threatening our democracy, threatening our rights, threatening our freedoms. And here's how they're doing it. I mean, it isn't that hard to do that. I mean, she seems to me to be, I mean, these aren't prepared speeches. She's just saying this off the cuff on Stephen Colbert. You know, I mean, it's not like, you know, I mean, it doesn't seem like it's that hard to do that. But very few people are speaking clearly on this. And there are some. I mean, I think Elizabeth Warren has been, you know, passionate on these issues since it happened. There have been others, too. You know, you'll see them. Somebody come on TV, Brian Schatz, of, you know, the senator from Hawaii. He's very good as well on social media. There are some who are just out there saying, hey, you know, look, you know, wake up. And that's essentially what it is wake up. This thing is happening. It's real. This isn't hyperbole. This is actually happening. Look at what the court just did. Look, that's all you need to know. That was Mitch McConnell's plan. He fulfilled his plan, and he's not done yet. And, you know, here's some things that we have to do now. We've got to start getting serious about this. But, you know, this somnambulant approach on the part of the White House and kind of, well, you know, we really maybe we'll do the filibuster. For abortion, we might do that because maybe that's a good idea, and maybe voting rights or something like that. No, the filibuster, well, it should have been gone a year ago. But, you know, the fact is that is something they can run on this fall. Just go, we have to have two more senators. We have to have it because mm-hmm. if we don't, everything is going to go. We have to have two more senators. We've got to get rid of the filibuster. So, you know, this is the kind of thing I think that they... like I said at the beginning, I feel like there's a sense of paralysis among the Democratic leadership. And I honestly, you know, I just want to be like Cher in Moonstruck and slap them across the face and go, you know, snap out of it. You know, they've got to, that this idea that you can just sort of let things unfold and hope that people, at some point sort of recognize that threat that's coming from the right and they'll can get out and vote and gosh, do it. Well, by the way, if this case that the Supreme Court decided to take up next term, by the time 2024 comes along, it won't matter how many people have voted.
Right.
Yeah. Swing states, they could have a huge turnout among Democrats. They could win by, you know, hundreds of thousands of votes, and it won't make a difference because the state legislatures can decide that there was the count was tainted somehow and overturn it. So, you know, this is pretty urgent. It's pretty urgent, and it's tremendously depressing, I have to admit. I mean, I'm a little shaken by what I saw this week.
Heather Parton, Digby, as always, well, I can't even say a pleasure. I mean, it's always a pleasure.
Catharsis.
A laugh,
huh?
Catharsis.
It's been a rough, yeah. Rough couple of years.
It has.
But thank you. I appreciate the insight.
I was going to say my pleasure, but I'll just say you're welcome instead.
Yes, we'll see you soon. Thanks, Heather.
Thanks. Have a great weekend, everybody.
You too.
All right, folks. Depressing week. And it was foretold. I mean, we knew it was coming, not necessarily exactly in this form. We thought maybe there might be a chance that it... you know, things would have been a little bit different. But here we are. And speaking of which, there we go. We're going to head to the fun half. You can be part of the program. IM us. Pick up the app at majorityapp.com. You can IM the show. Also, we may take calls. Maybe not. I'm not sure. 646-257-3920. We will see. Don't forget justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. It's all fair trade. Great company. Great coffee. Can't go wrong. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe? You're flying the COVID solo train.
Yeah, although David and I will have an interview for patrons this evening with Lee Phillips talking about his book on actually against degrowth and criticizing even people like Naomi Klein for degrowth ideas. So it's a bit more contentious climate change thing, I guess, maybe to distract from people. But Lee's got a lot of spicy opinions about certain, I guess, NGO ways of doing climate change that I think people are going to be intrigued by. So patreon.com just left reckoning to hear that.
Interesting. All right, folks. See you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What?
What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who? What is up, everyone? Nomi Key.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
All right, me? You think?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm gonna go for a ride.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I wanna say.
857-210-35-501.
One half.
3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes satire.
On top of it all, my favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you.
All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.